Weekly Macro Summary. There have been quite a few interesting events to analyze this week, and below I list the most noteworthy news. Let's get started. The war with Iran is entering a more delicate and, above all, more binary phase. Pete Hegseth made it clear that the coming days will be decisive, combining the usual offer of a deal with an explicit threat of escalation if Tehran does not yield. In other words, Washington is still trying to present the diplomatic path as open, but the real message is that it is negotiating from a position of strength and with very little interest in concealing it. On the other side, Iran responded by widening the perimeter of the conflict, not only on the military front but also on the economic one, by threatening major U.S. corporations with a presence in the region. That list, which includes companies ranging from Microsoft and Google to Boeing and Tesla, is aimed at raising the perceived cost of the war and reminding everyone that the conflict is no longer limited to bases, militias, or energy facilities. The Strait of Hormuz remains the true center of gravity of the conflict, because it turns a regional war into a global energy shock, and the solutions now being discussed, which involve Iran establishing a permanent toll, would amount to a constant sort of Damocles hanging over the energy market, which would therefore deserve a geopolitical premium. Trump's speech on Wednesday did nothing to calm tensions, and it already seems quite clear that there is no real plan and that nothing will return to the way it was before. That shock is already beginning to filter into the real economy. In the United States, gasoline has risen above $4 per gallon for the first time in more than 3 years, which creates a first-order political problem for Trump and the Republicans ahead of the midterms, which are already being written off here, with expectations of a blue wave both in those elections and in the 2028 presidential race. Some conflicts are fought on the military front, while others are fought in the voter's wallet. This one threatens to do both at once. That is why the White House insists on projecting military resolve while still leaving the door open to a negotiated exit. It needs to project strength, but it also needs to avoid higher energy costs damaging consumption, confidence, and ultimately the economic cycle. Internationally, visible cracks are also beginning to emerge. France and Italy have expressed reservations about parts of the military operations, the Pope has openly called for a way out, and China and Pakistan are pressing for an immediate ceasefire. In other words, the longer the war drags on, the harder it will be to maintain a coherent political coalition around Washington and Tel Aviv. The problem with long wars is not just their material cost, but that they gradually erode the legitimacy of those who sustain them. And that now seems to be starting to happen. In that scenario, energy once again moves to the center of the board. And, as so often happens, when geopolitics comes in through the door, market complacency goes out the window. Quality investing has come into fashion on the back of a fantastic decade, but it contains far more problems than might initially be assumed. Nike remains stuck in a restructuring that is moving more slowly than the market had expected. Although third quarter figures came in somewhat better than feared, with revenue flat at $11.28 billion and EPS of 35 cents, beating estimates, guidance for the fourth quarter was clearly disappointing, with sales expected to decline by 2% to 4%, versus the slight growth the consensus had been pricing in. The underlying problem has not changed. China continues to be the main drag, not only because of weak demand and competitive pressure from local brands such as Anta and Li Ning, but also because Nike is still digesting operational mistakes and excess inventory. In fact, the company itself is forecasting a 20% collapse in sales in the region next quarter. The recent improvement there, after falling only 10% compared with the previous minus 16%, is real, but still far from sufficient. The other major bottleneck is inventory. Nike is still relying on promotions to clear older product, especially in Europe and in its digital channel, which inevitably erodes margins. It is therefore no surprise that gross margin has contracted again for the sixth consecutive quarter, falling 130 basis points to 40.2%, with the impact of tariffs adding further pressure. The problem is that the market is beginning to wonder how much longer this cleanup can last, especially when Nike has spent several quarters promising progress without fully normalizing the business. As noted at the beginning, this is a world-leading brand, with products at the technological frontier, yet whose stock market performance has been, at the very least, disappointing. Price is always the most important thing, and drifting away from that discipline has damaging consequences. Pam Bondi's dismissal is a fairly revealing signal of how this White House understands loyalty and the political usefulness of institutions. Bondi is not being removed because she was somehow outside the Trump orbit. Quite the opposite, she had been one of his most reliable allies, both during the 2020 impeachment and in defending the subsequent electoral narrative. Precisely for that reason, her departure carries greater political weight, because it shows that in this environment not even loyalty guarantees survival if it ceases to be functional. The immediate trigger appears to have been the handling of the Epstein case, which has become a growing source of noise within the Republican bloc itself. The delay in releasing documents, the errors in the redactions, and the accidental exposure of victims' names have given ammunition both to the opposition and to sectors of Trump's own base. The subpoena from the Oversight Committee led by Republicans was already a clear sign that Bondi was starting to become a liability. But limiting the interpretation to the Epstein case would fall short. Bondi was also under pressure for not having carried out aggressively enough the other major function Trump expects from his justice apparatus, going after political enemies. That is the real substance of the matter. In Trump's universe, as in any banana republic, the Department of Justice is not merely a state institution, but a tool of power. It is not enough to want to fight the battle, it has to be done effectively. The choice of Todd Blanche as interim replacement fits perfectly with that logic. A man with a direct personal link to Trump and a far more combative profile when dealing with judges, career prosecutors, and internal checks. It is a move that will likely intensify the politicization of the DOJ rather than correct it. The market or institutional reading here is clear. Trump's second term continues to consolidate an increasingly personalist model of power, in which job security depends less on technical performance than on the ability to execute the president's political agenda without creating excessive collateral costs. The saga and hype around SpaceX's potential IPO continues to build, and it would be far more than just another major tech listing. It could become the defining financial event of the cycle. If a valuation above $1.75 trillion and a capital raise of more than $50 billion are ultimately confirmed, we would be talking not only about the largest IPO in history, but also about the arrival in public markets of one of the most coveted private assets in the world. In any case, the key is not so much the rockets as Starlink, which is precisely why this matters so much for ASTS. The epic narrative of colonizing Mars, returning to the moon, or putting data centers into orbit helps sustain the story, but the part that truly makes evaluation of this magnitude defensible is the recurring satellite connectivity business. That is where the market may begin to see a very unusual and difficult to replicate combination: critical infrastructure with growth, defense contracts, geopolitical exposure, and a proprietary network already deployed on a global scale. The Musk dream adds to the appeal, but the potential cash generation is explained above all by Starlink. That said, the deal would also open a very interesting Pandora's box. A publicly listed SpaceX would force the market to price what could be called the Muskonomy far more rigorously, that increasingly intertwined ecosystem made up of Tesla, XAI, X, SpaceX, and the rest of his assets. So far, much of that value has moved in private markets, with less transparency and far more room for narrative permissiveness. Going public would imply much greater scrutiny of corporate governance, capital allocation, control structures, and above all the extent to which a single individual can continue simultaneously running several enormous companies without real frictions emerging. That is probably the main perception risk. SpaceX may be an extraordinary asset, but it would also come to market carrying an enormous narrative premium. And when a company goes public wrapped in an almost mythical story, the margin for disappointment narrows. It would not be surprising to see a valuation heavily dependent on the market's faith in Musk, more akin to Tesla than to a traditional aerospace company. That can work strongly in its favor at the debut, but it also implies considerable potential volatility once the market starts separating fantasy, optionality, and tangible profits. We have passed the point of no return in the global oil market. After a month of war, with disruptions affecting roughly 20 megabits/d transiting through the strait, the loss of inventories is already enormous and will have long-term consequences for the crude market. The market, including what is often referred to as smart money, still seems oblivious to this structural shift and continues to operate with a buy-the-dip mentality and first-order thinking, going short oil while waiting for the longed-for taco headline. The Trump administration is reportedly considering a long-term solution based on an Iranian toll on cargoes transiting the strait. On paper, it sounds workable, since it would only raise cargo costs by around 1%, but in practice it is unviable because it would alter the balance of power among the Gulf countries and leave the rest under a constant threat. More specifically, it is highly unlikely that either Saudi Arabia or the UAE would accept such an arrangement, as it would leave them hostage to Persian leverage. As a result, it is likely that they will begin using their substantial influence in Washington to block such a resolution. Past this point of no return, the only sector that still looks clearly attractive is energy, and the broader market, both the indices and the rest of the sectors, is likely to wake up to a harsh reality in the coming weeks. Model portfolio. Year to date, the model portfolio is up plus 20.25%, versus minus 1.91% for the S&P 500, S&P and Euros, and plus 210.0% since inception, September 2022, compared with plus 47.4% for the S&P 500. The model portfolio, as of Friday's close, is as follows. Warning emoji, past performance does not guarantee future results. The historical performance of the model portfolio is shown for informational and educational purposes only and does not constitute investment advice or an offer to buy or sell securities. The returns shown may not include fees, taxes, or other associated costs. After Donald Trump's speech on Wednesday, the impression was that the conflict is likely to drag on, which means there now appears to be no real turning back from the consequences that will follow. With that in mind, a large number of energy positions have been added to the model portfolios, as this is the only sector that appears clearly positioned to generate value over the coming quarters. Specifically, addition of Morel at PROM at your 10.45/share. Addition of Saturn Oil at CAD 6.40/share. Increase in CVE Energy at CAD 37.78/share. Increase in Suncor Energy at CAD 93.39/share. Increase in WCP at CAD 15.34/share. Following these moves, cash in the model portfolio stands at 12%, while energy exposure reaches approximately 50% of the total. Next, we will review the main developments from the model portfolio companies during the week. Suncor used its 2026 investor day to reinforce a message of growth and continuous improvement, signaling that it is entering a new phase of operational progress with higher growth, a lower break-even, and greater capital returns to shareholders. The most visible announcement is the increase of more than 20% in share buybacks, to $4 billion in 2026, but that is really more the consequence of a broader ambition, to raise normalized free cash flow by $2 billion by 2028. In addition, Suncor aims to reduce its corporate breakeven by $5 per barrel, down to $38 WTI, add 100,000 barrels per day of upstream production, and increase nominal refining capacity by 10%, to 511,000 barrels per day. On top of that, it is adding 11 billion barrels of contingent resources, bringing the total to 30 billion barrels, with no exploration risk, and a future production capacity of 400,000 barrels per day at an average cost of $30,000 per flowing barrel. In other words, visible growth, deep inventory, and attractive incremental profitability. What matters here is that Suncor continues to stand out as one of the most interesting integrated majors in the Canadian space, precisely because it combines three things that the market often undervalues when it looks at the sector too simplistically: long-duration assets, strong operational optionality, and a very reasonable ability to turn internal improvements into real cash for shareholders. If execution is strong, this is not just a buyback story, but a potential re-rating of the quality of the business. The energy market is increasingly rewarding companies that can grow without sharply increasing capex or impairing returns, and that is exactly what Suncor is trying to sell. Cerrado's results show a situation that is fairly familiar in the small-cap miner space, an operating asset that works reasonably well and generates cash in a very favorable gold price environment, but with several open corporate fronts that prevent the equity story from being perceived as simple or clean. In other words, the quarter was operationally good, but the thesis still depends on more than just MDN. At Minera Don Nicolás, 2025 was clearly a transition year. Production of 50,238 GEO and an AISC of $1,746 per ounce came in line with guidance, which is already positive when taking into account the water issues that limited the heap leach during part of the year. In fact, much of the quarter's interpretation comes down to that. The operation did not stand out for growth, but it did show resilience. Production held up, costs remained reasonably controlled despite inflation and water purchases, and leverage to the gold price did the rest. It is no surprise that adjusted EBITDA for Q4 and for the full year reached record levels. The most interesting point is probably not the close of 2025, but rather the setup for 2026. Guidance of 50,000 to 60,000 GEO, weighted toward the second half of the year, suggests that the company expects gradual improvement as underground mining gains weight and the heap leach returns to more normal operations. We should get an updated MRE or clear signals around mine life expansion next month, which will be the key lever for a re-rating. Looking at the numbers, the low realized gold price stands out, but that is due to a very weak hedging book. With the hedge book now completed, Cerrado is fully leveraged to gold, and in the current environment that could be very attractive. At MDN, the business appears to be moving in the right direction, but it still is not a fully stabilized operation. At the corporate level, the picture is also more complex. Lagoa Salgada remains wrapped in regulatory uncertainty following the unfavorable opinion from the Portuguese Environmental Agency, even though the company is trying to defend its position through the courts. If this project were ultimately worth zero, it would be a hard blow. Mont Sorcier remains an interesting source of optionality, especially because of its exposure to high-grade iron ore tied to the green steel narrative, but it is still a development project, not a current source of cash flow, and it requires a huge amount of capex. In other words, the market is currently financing a story in which MDN supports the group while the rest of the assets try to mature without consuming too much credibility or too much of the balance sheet. If MDN consolidates its underground ramp-up in 2026 and gold remains strong, the re-rating potential is there. But it remains a thesis where the upside depends as much on the metal as on the company's ability to simplify and execute its asset structure more effectively. The Kamoa-Kakula update was a disaster, although it leaves a mixed reading and not an outright negative one if viewed with some time perspective. In the short term, the message is clearly worse than the market would have wanted to hear. Production guidance for 2026 and 2027 has been cut materially, costs are coming in higher than expected, and it is also quite clear that management has chosen to prioritize geotechnical stability, underground development, and infrastructure rather than forcing tonnage. In plain terms, less copper today in order to try to secure more copper tomorrow, and produced at a higher cost. That explains the core of the announcement. The resource remains extraordinary, 1.27 billion indicated tons grading 2.65%, for 34 million tons of contained copper, something very few assets in the world can match in terms of size and grade. The reserve, however, falls sharply versus the prior plan, to 466 million tons at 2.82%, containing 13.1 million tons of copper. This is not a case of geological deterioration across the district, but rather a more conservative redesign of the mine plan after the problems experienced at Kakula. In other words, the asset remains world-class, but the conversion of that resource into profitable production will be less linear and more demanding than previously assumed. What matters is that the company seems to have abandoned any temptation to sell a quick recovery and has instead chosen to reset expectations. Guided production of 290 to 330 kilotons in 2026 and 380 to 420 kilotons in 2027 comes in well below previous targets, while C1 costs rise to $2.60-$3.00 per pound in 2026 and $2.10-$2.50 per pound in 2027. Even so, if the new plan works, the asset should again exceed 500 kilotons per year from 2028 onward, with costs close to $2 per pound. That is the real message they are trying to convey. Sacrifice 2 years in order to return to a more sustainable and productive path for decades. From a thesis perspective, this reinforces a familiar idea in mining. A great ore body does not always mean easy execution, as already seen with Adriatic Metals. Kamoa-Kakula is still probably one of the best copper assets in the world on paper, but the market has now seen that the quality of the mineral body does not eliminate either operational or geotechnical risk. That is why the value today depends less on the geological blue sky upside, which remains intact, and more on management's credibility in executing this new plan without further setbacks. The positive side is that the long-term optionality remains enormous. The 34 megatons of contained copper in indicated resources, the future possibility of a Phase 4 expansion, the smelter already ramping up, and the expected margin improvement from sulfuric acid and lower logistics costs are all still there. But after this announcement, the market will probably begin to value Kamoa-Kakula with a less idealized lens and one more grounded in the realities of underground mine development. Another good week of value creation by portfolio companies.